Well, this week the Dow Jones Industrials blasted higher for the seventh week in a row, closing above the 16,000 level for the first time. Welcome back to GoldSeek.com Radio, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, with you. Well, we have a big blockbuster show lined up for you this weekend on this November 22nd broadcast. Gerald Celente and I examine the economy. It's a tale of two economies, he says, with the headline numbers touting solid employment figures and low inflation. But behind the scenes, good jobs are hard to find. Despite government figures to the contrary, prices also continue to move higher. Expenses across the board are eroding people's incomes as fast as it is earned. Then Andy Hoffman makes his debut appearance on the show. The Gold Bull thinks that eventually the market will find its footing, setting the stage for spectacular gains. And Robert Ian wraps up the broadcast with his latest editorial. GoldSeek.com Radio begins now with the Market Weatherman Report. Mostly cloudy skies appeared over the precious metals exchanges this week on hawkish rhetoric from the FOMC meeting minutes. Investors chose the sidelines despite the second consecutive week of dollar sluggishness. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold shed only about $50, finishing at $1,243 an ounce. Silver declined by just less than a dollar, ending at $1,983. Demand for gold jewelry, bars, and coins increased 20% in the latest reading from the World Gold Council. Demand continues to soar as well in China, which is now expected to be the world's largest consumer and producer, where its citizens will buy at least 30% more of the yellow metal this year alone, around 1,000 tons. The Roaring Tiger Nation will begin gold swap trading on November 25th on the China Foreign Exchange Trade System. The contracts are delivered via the Shanghai Gold Exchange. Central banks are also increasing their gold stockpiles. Turkey's central bank added 13 tons. Kazakhstan's gold reserves rose by 2.5 tons. And Azerbaijan's gold reserves increased 2 tons last month. In related news, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange Group reduced the margin requirements on precious metals contracts, reducing the initial margin requirement on gold by 10%, down to about $8,000 from $8,800 per 100-ounce contract. The COMEX 5,000 Silver Futures SI ticker symbol margins dropped by 11% to $11,000 per contract, a sizable drop, down from $12,400. One media source noted trading manipulation, though, on the COMEX this week. Following at least 2 trading halts on the exchange, the UK financial regulator is reportedly probing for rigging operations. Bottom line on precious metals. Well, although the market is entering a traditionally strong season for gold due to holiday-related purchases, and particularly for jewelry, the technical situation is a bit problematic. So if you are an Alpha's newsletter subscriber, please log in for an important report this week with all the technical charts and next week's stock candidates. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility was virtually unlimited over the NYSE for the seventh consecutive week. The Dow Jones Industrials recorded yet another all-time record close, finishing above 16,000 for the first time in its history. Investors were encouraged by robust domestic economic reports. By Friday's closing bell on the New York Stock Exchange, the Dow Jones Industrials added about 100 points, up less than a percent, ending at 16,064. The S&P 500 added 7 points, ending at 1804, and the NASDAQ added 5 points, ending at 3991, on track for that 4,000 point, and maybe even that 5,000 peak we saw way back in the dot-com mania year 2000. According to the Fed minutes released this week, officials now expect unemployment to reach targeted levels, reducing the need for the monthly $85 billion in toxic asset purchases. U.S. jobless claims dropped to the lowest point in 2 months, and October retail sales improved sharply. Nevertheless, the new Fed chair-elect Janet Yellen, expected to take over the helm at the Fed on January 31st, noted that the economy and the labor market must improve before bond buying is reduced. On close examination of the FOMC report, officials may stop voting on debt purchases but once per year, while other monetary stimulus measures may now be considered mandatory. This has led a few astute market watchers to note this week that there seems to be a mini coup on the last meeting, giving the doves the upper hand. Positive news for the precious metals and for stocks. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, according to the 7-component fear sentiment index, greed is still nearing overbought levels. However, the technical situation remains bullish amid the favorable pre-holiday season. For the rest of this report, next week's forecast, and all the stock candidates, be sure to log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account by Monday morning. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Trends Doomsayer Gerald Celente and Gold Bull Andy Hoffman. Well, most investors have heard of peak oil. My next guest is a market analyst who says that the world could soon be facing peak silver. Joining me in his debut appearance to discuss the precious metals market, welcome Andy Hoffman.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Miles Franklin Precious Metals. We're a bullion dealer. And after all these years of listening to you, it's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, let's begin, if we could, with the idea of silver extinction. Currently, silver is widely extant, but you note that it could be the first element to go the way of the dinosaurs. You showed the historic gold-to-silver production ratio, roughly 16 to 1, has declined to as low as 9 to 1. And I think this is, you know, really quite an interesting finding, given the advances that we've had in recent decades in mining technology. You say this is due to the fact that silver is primarily the result of base metal production. Care to pick up the ball and tell folks more, please?
Yes, if you're referring peak silver per se, it relates to the fact that, as you said, the gold-silver ratio out of the earth, or should I say the silver-to-gold ratio, has historically been 15 to 16 to 1. But in recent decades, it's fallen to 9 to 1 because silver production has depleted more rapidly than gold production. And moreover, 70% of all the world's silver production is byproduct from base metals. And now that we're in a weak economic environment, the outlook for a lot of major new base metal mines is not very good. Moreover, from the standpoint of the cost of mining primary silver, it's anywhere between $22 and $30 per ounce. So right now we are way below the cost of production for the average silver mine around the world. And, you know, with the prices being held down here so low, the odds are we're going to see production fall significantly in the coming years. Moreover, unlike gold, where just about all the gold that's ever been mined is still above ground, nearly all the silver has been consumed by industry. So there's really no more than maybe 2 billion ounces above ground in the entire world, most of which is sitting in vaults of people that are never getting rid of it.
You know, there's another little known fact about silver. Unlike gold, silver tends to pool in its deposits, that is, near the Earth's surface. Silver has essentially accumulated near the Earth's crust. That would make one assume that, well, maybe much of it has already been mined.
Well, I'm no geologist, although I did work in the mining industry for 5 years and did my best to work with the lingo. But the fact is, in the same way you talk about the gold rush of 1849 and all the other famous gold rushes, or for that matter, any commodity rush, like when they find oil, then it becomes significantly more expensive and difficult to mine in subsequent years, which is why you're seeing the cost of many commodities. I was an oil analyst for 10 years, and the cost of producing oil has dramatically increased because they've gotten all the simple stuff and now they have to go to deep water and offshore and to very difficult places around the world. And the same thing goes with mining, where just the permitting process alone is extremely expensive, let alone the heap leaching and all the chemicals and processing and transportation. So if that is the case, that the average silver find has been much closer to the surface of the earth, the odds are, as you said, it's probably been mined already.
You also show that virtually all of the silver mined is used by industry purposes, and I'm sure many of our listeners by now know that everything from cell phones to computer keyboards, even the smallest electronic product, uses incremental tiny amounts of silver. It is the world's best electrical conductor. Very few people, I think, know this. Most people assume that it's gold. It's not. Silver, by far, a better conductor, the most reflective of metals. It's only second to gold in malleability and ductility. Quite a unique quality, I think you'd agree, for a monetary metal.
Silver, as you said, has these indispensable qualities about it that that make it very difficult to substitute, especially because it's such a reasonable price right now. And if, again, if you look at the things that it's being used for, and I'm not even talking about cell phones, I'm talking about, you know, things like medical and, you know, those kind of things, the new solar panels, all these things, these are indispensable businesses. And as you said, they're very small amounts, generally speaking, in all these things. So not only does the price not matter that much, but they don't tend to be recycled in large quantities. So, you know, from a fundamental standpoint, simply from demand, in which roughly 75% of the of all the supply is taken up by industry in any given year, there's really not that much out there for people to invest in. And given there's not much inventory to start with, it shows you how tight this market already is. And what it could become. Look, remember, we've had numerous shortages of silver just in the last 5 years. In 2008, of course, where we had premiums go to 100%. In 2011, silver went to $50. We ran out of silver. Earlier this year, not once but twice, first in January where the mint sold out and it's been a record year, and then again in April after the cartel smashed the price down, we ran out of silver again temporarily. So it's a very tight market, and it wouldn't take much for it to really explode on the upside.
Well, you brought up one of our favorite industries, and that, of course, the solar sector, red hot for most of the year, up at one point as a sector by roughly 1,000%, depending on which index you look at. And one of our favorite picks, First Solar, they're up over 100% since we first offered that on the Alpha Stocks newsletter. Silver is an essential component in solar panels, and according to one source, as much as an ounce of silver per solar panel. I'd also like to discuss investment grade silver is really quite rare. I think few people realize that there's less than 1/10 an ounce of silver available to every global inhabitant. So in other words, if we took all the available silver, you couldn't essentially even give a dime to every person on the earth. That would seem to indicate that picking up silver at discounted prices at these levels could pay off. Any comments?
I mean, when you talk about silver, again, yes, there's probably 2 billion ounces above ground to start with. And I've gone over the numbers with David Morgan and with numerous other people. I mean, that's probably the max that's out there. And I'm not talking about the stuff that's sitting in relics, in artifacts, in churches and stuff like that. I'm talking about actual above-ground investment-grade silver is probably no more than 2 billion ounces. But that's most of that, as I said, is sitting in vaults. Like the silver that I own, personally, it's not going anywhere. So probably of that 2 billion ounces, there can't be, you know, more than a quarter of that is actually available for sale. And again, you look at the COMEX where there's only, I think, 44 million ounces in the registered category, which is, you know, worth less than $1 billion. There's just not that much out there. So from both a supply standpoint and a demand standpoint, remember, even in this year where they've smashed prices down, we have already surpassed 2011's record Silver Eagle purchases from the U.S. Mint. India, despite all of their tariffs, they already have record silver demand. So very tight on both sides. I mean, at some point, something has to give with all the money printing out there.
I think a big component of the Indian silver story is obviously the levies placed on gold to try to support the rupee currency in that nation. But either way, silver, a perennial favorite of that subcontinent. Of course, China just surpassed India as the world's largest consumer of gold. You know, gold, the only form of money that has held up for, well, you could argue 5,000-6,000 years of monetary history, simply has never imploded as a currency. But for some reason, we always seem to forget this and shift back to a fiat. I'd like your comments on whether or not you expect that history to repeat itself again here in the U.S.
Well, it has to. Again, you know, when you talk about money per se, people throw around the term money loosely when, you know, when the dollar is actually just currency. If you want to look at what the definition of money is, it can't just be a medium of exchange. It also has to be a store of value. It has to be scarce. It has to be verifiable. That is, you know how much is out there and how much is being printed. So really, on none of those, and of course it has to be fungible, and on none of those levels, does the dollar or the euro make the definition of as far as the dollar's medium of exchange? Really, only in the United States can you use a dollar. And now that they have 20 different forms of $100 bills, they're barely even fungible anymore because no one trusts them. I mean, you go around the world, and the dollar, the $100 bill is the most counterfeited bill in the world. So, you know, when it comes to money, the dollar is even less money than it's ever been before. And that's why people are looking at things like Bitcoin and, of course, gold and silver. The difference being between those two, that Bitcoin does not have futures exchanges that you can naked short them, whereas gold and silver do.
You know, Bitcoin, quite a phenomenon. We first brought it to the attention of our listeners at around, I want to say, $40. A lot of emails, especially since we crossed $600, up $100 in just a day, up 50% in just 1 week on Bitcoins, moving from 400 to 600 last week. A lot of emails from people, and I try to steer them back to precious metals. Most of these messages ask, can you please simply tell us what it is in one or two sentences? And I just try to point out, look, a Bitcoin is simply something that requires a computer considerable time and resources to find. That's one of the things that makes it valuable. The other, it's scarcity. And then the other thing that makes it valuable is currently it's not really controlled or restricted by government, although that's changing almost weekly now. Those two characteristics make it desirable. If Bitcoins can soar from $4 to $400, $500, $600 in a year, imagine what gold and silver can do when people start to wake up and realize their currency is little more than thin air.
I've done as much as I can, as much research as possible can. I've written two pieces about them. In fact, I actually did an interview 6 hours before the first big crash in April, and I said, it feels like the Internet right here because everyone's emailing me, whereas when I did my piece 2 weeks ago and it was 270, I said it does not feel like the Internet because no one's talking about it. Of course, that has changed in the ensuing 2 weeks. In fact, we hit $1,000 briefly last night per Bitcoin, which means one of these digital things, you know, yes, they have a cost of production, but not that much, was almost worth what an ounce of gold is, which is just shows you, look, to me, this is an investment. Maybe one day it'll be considered money. But as I said with the definition, right now it's just an intriguing technology and people are speculating on it because they're talking about all the demand in China. Hey, look, gold demand in China is going to double this year from last year's record levels. But again, as you said, there's no one controlling it right now. There's no one managing it. And certainly there's no mechanism to naked short it. So right now it seems like this very interesting, quote, investment, but I would bet that 90% of the people that are buying it have no idea how it works. And, you know, to this day, I still am not quite sure about it, although I will certainly read more.
Take a look at what people are really saying. When they buy a Bitcoin, when they buy some of the alternatives to Bitcoin, they're saying, look, we want an alternative to our currency, to worthless money. We want an alternative that is essentially untrackable and holds its purchasing power. And you are right. I mean, this is obviously a fad, and there are some frothy aspects to it. And I certainly don't encourage people to go buy Bitcoins at these levels. But what's going to happen when the power goes out? If the lights go out, the computers turn off, the government decides to regulate Bitcoins, what happens to your investment, okay? Conversely, look at gold and silver. The lights go off, the power goes off. I can't think of anything much more valuable. There's a government shutdown, there is civil disobedience, unrest, government profligacy continues at this rapid pace. The Fed adds another $1 trillion, maybe $2 trillion next year under Dr. Yellen's leadership. Who knows what's going to happen to the Fed's balance sheet in the coming years? Add that all up. I would much rather have a bag of even silver dimes or quarters than a few digital Bitcoins. That I challenge you to walk to the grocery store, drive to the grocery store, and purchase a bag of groceries with some Bitcoins.
The Fed has created, in our just this generation, they've created numerous bubbles, one worse than the last. You can go back to, of course, the Internet bubble and then the real estate bubble, which had the crash in 2008. And now what we have now, which is not only treasuries, but basically all financial instruments. And so it's created this this moral hazard of the Bernanke put, where any financial asset is bought, and that's, you know, Bitcoin is being embraced because it's yes, it's an alternative currency like gold, but at the same time, to me, it's more an investment than anything else right now. And as you said, there's plenty of flaws in it. It does not meet the definition of money, certainly not right now. And in the worst case scenario, 6,000 years of history is not going to be changed. But the thing that really gets me irritated the most is when people make it seem like, well, we don't get it. Like the world is changing so fast technologically that, I mean, you not understand Bitcoins. It's how the world is. Look, back in 1999, they said that about Internet companies, and they've said that about countless things over the years. The fact is, there's only a handful of things that have lasted the test of time. And in the monetary realm, only gold and silver have done so. And I can almost assure you when the next crisis occurs, it's not going to be Bitcoin that the whole world is.
Let's take a look at the U.S. Constitution. You know, as I'm sure you know, it specifies as gold and silver coin are the only legal tender. The Coinage Act, I believe it was 1792, declared that the U.S. dollar must be 371 grains pure silver. It mentions very little about gold. You know, digital currencies are not money. Neither are worthless greenbacks, which were, remember, pulled out of circulation following the Civil War and somehow found their way back into circulation. The legal currency is primarily silver. In fact, that's the very definition of a dollar or taler, which it was originally based on.
I mean, to me, the biggest thing that's going on, it's two things. One, it's this financial asset blow-up that the Fed has caused, and obviously the PPT and other aspects of the government are supporting this. They actually did lie about the unemployment report back in October 2012. Everyone knew that. But aside from that, just the disconnect between the real economy and this so-called recovery has never been more wide. I mean, company after company is warning of the worst retail holiday season since the bottom in 2008-2009. This has been the worst earnings seasons for pre-announcements in history, and outside the banking sector, earnings growth has been zero. And of course, the markets have gone up due to unprecedented increases in PE multiples. This is the final stages of a blow off in financial assets caused by the Fed. And at some point, the reality is going to set in either because the markets crash back to earth or because they start to lose all their gains to inflation and they become nominal instead of real gains.
We talked about the Fed pumping an inordinate amount of money and liquidity into the system. And then, of course, we have large corporations simply cutting back on their workforce. And this works well in the short term. You know, you cut back, you make your company lean and mean, but eventually you pay for that over time as you lose a lot of the intellectual capital of your firm and the nation, as you say, the disparity between the haves and have-nots is really a frightening number, according to some metrics, approaching 100 million able-bodied folks out of work if you include all of the metrics going back to the 1980s. You look at John Williams' shadow stats numbers, we're approaching a 25% unemployment rate if you use the original metric. So, I mean, there are some huge systemic issues that we're facing, and eventually, if we start to see those equities roll over, there's going to be huge money flows out of stocks and bonds somewhere. I can't see that going into real estate for the most part. That leaves the commodities and, more importantly, precious metals. Any thoughts?
I don't say per se that they're going to crash because I see the money printing behind it that's only going to accelerate. If you look at Zimbabwe, if you look at Weimar Germany, if you look at any of the 27 hyperinflations of the 20th century, it's always the same. The stock markets start out making the big gains in real terms as a safe haven, and ultimately the stock markets are big losers in real terms because inflation overtakes them. That happens all the time. If I had to guess what's going to ultimately happen, I would bet that the stock markets go a lot higher. But in time, the cost of living goes even higher than that, as will the price of gold and silver. Now, look, anything could happen, but we're past the point of no return with the money printing, the Ponzi scheme that it is. It has to grow larger. So we're going to see at some point QE5, 6, 7, until eventually the system falls upon itself. And, will stocks fall in real terms or will they simply fall? I'm not sure, but either way, gold and silver are going to outperform both cases.
You know, keeping with that Weimar analogy, I think it's apropos because we look at the correlation matrices. Generally speaking, gold tends to underperform when stocks and equities do well and vice versa. But if we look at the Weimar example, you reach this new threshold, if you will. We might be actually entering such a scenario now where gold and the Dow reach a 1-to-1 ratio at much, much higher prices. And of course, that would be music to the ears of precious metals investors.
Yeah, I mean, if I had to guess, I would say that's more likely given the scenario that's going on right now. But again, it really, I'm not concerned so much about the Dow. As you said, it's clearly no longer an indication of the economy. It's so manipulated. by the POMO, that is the Permanent Open Market Operations, and the Working Group on Capital Markets. You know, a lot of these terms that we've heard before no longer mean anything. Even a bull market, you know, can anyone truly say gold's in a bear market when we're going to have record physical demand this year and the plummeting physical inventories? I mean, can anyone truly say the U.S. is in recovery just because the government posts a 2% GDP for a couple of quarters in a row when clearly the real data says otherwise? None of these things matter anymore. What matters is that you see what's really going on in the world and that you are protected from the most likely scenarios, which are going to be real losses in assets other than, you know, things like gold and silver.
Well, not to mention, I think it's such a wonderful shield against declining purchasing power as a long-term investor, or you can think about the dislocation that comes from sudden economic collapse, as, once again, alluding back to Weimar or any of the other collapses we saw, Argentina, Venezuela, and several others more recently. You can wake up and find out that an MF Global scenario has come to pass, a Cyprus situation, more recently as occurred in Poland, where essentially half of pension funds evaporate with no remediation. These are all possible situations that every investor has to start preparing for, I think now, with all of this talk of bail-ins and the legislation that is slowly, covertly finding its way into our institutions as well as our government. So, Andy, as we wrap up here, any other issues that you'd like to share with folks?
You know, you mentioned Venezuela. That's been the poster child of exactly what I'm talking about. They are experiencing the early stages of hyperinflation as we speak. That, you know, their CPI is up 50% this year, and you know it's more than that. Their stock market is up 500% at the same time. This is exactly what I'm talking about, especially when you have the government supporting stocks as well. It becomes this frenzy where people don't realize, and I truly believe that the money printing must keep going. And, you know, Janet Yellen said it last week, I'm going to keep doing it indefinitely. The can gets kicked, has to end. And with the debts going up parabolically, and, you know, you saw the massive inflation that was exported around the world this year. The average currency is down 30% against the dollar over the last 2 years, particularly in these fragile five nations like India and Indonesia. I mean, something is going to give because the money printing that comes out of the States and gets exported everywhere is not going to stop.
As we wrap up here, I wonder if you could tell folks more about Miles Franklin, as well as any other contact information that you have, please.
Sure. Miles Franklin, we've been a bullion dealer for 24 years. You can contact us at 800-822-8080. I also write a free blog every day. In fact, three of us do at milesfranklin.com. And you can contact me at ahoffman@milesfranklin.com.
Very good. All right, Andy Hoffman, we want to thank you for your time today.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
Gerald Celente is the director of the Trends Research Institute. His team produces the Trends Journal with hard-hitting, in-depth analysis of the economic, socio-political, and cultural trends. Welcome back, Gerald Celente.
Thank you, Chris.
Lawrence Kotlikoff at Boston University claims that the U.S. is in a worse financial situation than even Greece. The U.S. government owes roughly $222 trillion in unfunded liabilities. I think this number is going to be 15 times, let's say, the annual GDP. You know, 10 to 12 years of everything produced in this country. Can we ever pay this back?
We can't even pay back the $17 trillion plus that we know that we have without all the other unfunded liabilities. How are they going to pay that one back? So no, the answer is no. It can't be done.
Imagine if you had to pay, let's say, 10, 15 times your annual salary. Well, you'd be working essentially for the rest of your life in order just to pay the debt off. There's no retirement there. And so there doesn't really seem to be a viable exit plan from this, unless we just cut everyone's benefits off. And the blowback would be enormous, I'm sure you'd agree.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there'd be revolution. that would be the blowback. And as we're listening to the new Fed chairman-to-be, Janet Yellen, and you really read her words, I mean, she admits that this is unprecedented what they're doing. This is all new territory, and they don't know how they're really going to unwind this QE2 or QE3 rather, and or future tapering. So and they really have no idea what the implications are going to be. We do, however. We believe we can see the future pretty well as far as the economy goes, and that is, despite the talk about tapering, and they may try to do some, but it's going to happen, as I've been saying all along, either late December or after just the beginning of the new year, for the specific purpose that they cannot afford to destabilize the retail sector during the heavy holiday buying season when shoppers are going deeper into debt to buy those gifts. So they were not going to rattle the markets on that. And we saw what happened when Bernanke first talked about tapering last spring, what happened to the world equity markets, particularly the emerging markets. So now, because of all the hot money, of course, flowing into them because of the cheap interest rates and all the availability of the money that they're printing, so the emerging markets really took it the hardest, but ours did as well. So here's our scenario. They're going to taper a bit. They're going to have to. And they're also facing the reality that when they do, interest rates are going to go up. When interest rates go up, the economy declines. And already, as they're announcing the possibilities of tapering, we're seeing bond prices start moving up. And that's when the big bubble bursts. It's the bond market. And as we see that number increase, and it becomes unsustainable, that's when you're going to see a crash that was worse than the panic of 2008. So those are the things we're looking at. And with the perfect understanding, and this isn't my understanding only, we just heard it from Andrew Hussar, who was with the Federal Reserve official, saying that the real purpose of the quantitative easing was to drive up the prices of the banks holding the debt instruments and to provide the banks with trillions of dollars at zero cost, which, of course, has led to the speculation.
The bond market, 40-year unbroken bull market, and so it would certainly be rife for a bubble bursting, if you will. And not to mention, think of the funds that will obviously have been flowing out of the sector somewhat recently into stocks. But, I mean, that money, which is an enormous amount of retirement funds, pension funds, mutual funds, I think it could overwhelm a small market like the precious metals. At some point, would you agree there'll have to be some traction? Because folks are going to be looking for an alternative to bonds in their portfolios.
On the short term, you know, I've been saying this, you know, for months. We have been forecasting gold prices to go lower. We even see them going between $100 and $150 lower than where they are now. But this is a short term downdraft as we see it, because there's no possible way that the central banks could sustain what they're doing. They're now talking in Europe about negative interest rates. If businesses, commercial businesses with large holdings, put money into the banks will then loan it back to them at minus 0.1%. That's how desperate they are to keep this thing going. You cannot keep interest rates at zero or minus zero. This is impossible. This is something that has never been done in the history of the world, part one or part two. So it's going to be an ugly ending. They have to unwind it at some point. You listen to Ben Bernanke earlier this week. He said that these low interest rates are making it possible for people to buy automobiles. Yeah, that's right. 0% interest rates. Step right up. No verification needed. Oh, no, it'll be nice. Don't worry about it. You can't find a good job? You're looking at wages going down? 95% of the jobs that were created are part-time jobs? Don't worry about it. Buy a new car. No, they're setting the whole thing is a bubble. It's going to burst, and that's why I'm in gold for the long term. And you know well that we do not take one page, one line of advertising in the Trends Journal. It's 52 pages, no advertising. No advertising on our website, so nobody pays us to say what we're saying. We say this in full confidence and full disclosure that we don't take a penny from anybody, and the only monies that we make are through our seminars, through our Trends Journals, and through my doing public speaking. So when I say I'm bullish on gold, and have been when I call the beginning of the gold bull run in 2001, there's no vested interest here other than my personal interests, and that is to be safe and secure in my golden years.
Turning back to Fed chair nominee, certainly last week made it clear that there would be plenty of monetary stimulus forthcoming. I think that was one of the big pieces of news that pushed the Dow out of its consolidation now up to an all-time record high, struggling a bit this week, but I think that's kind of normal after breaking out of a consolidation trading range.
Well, what they're saying is, you know, the Fed taper is likely to in coming months, according to the latest minutes. So they say that the members generally noted that there had been little change in the economic outlook since the September meeting, and the members, but they again say that they believe that the data is showing an improvement in labor market conditions and would thus warrant trimming the pace of purchases in coming months, end quote. And that's from the Federal Open Market Committee. So at their October 29th and 30th gathering, and that was just released. So they're throwing out that fig leaf of tapering, but if you read the language, and it's very important, that the committee's outlook for ongoing improvement in labor market conditions would thus warrant trimming the pace. What labor market are they looking at? They're certainly not looking at the U.S. labor market, because the U.S. labor market, as I mentioned, the largest percentage of jobs created are part-time jobs. And the only reason why the unemployment number is going down at all because of all the people that are no longer in the jobs market. So I don't know what kind of labor market they're talking about. And the other part of the labor market they're talking about, where there's the fastest growth, are in jobs that don't pay living wages, such as retail sector, home health aides, and waitresses and bartenders. You don't get rich and you can't buy a house making that kind of dough. And then again, when I mentioned houses, look at the latest housing data coming in. You're seeing a huge fall off of young people being able to buy houses. So they're talking about tapering, but the data they give for tapering doesn't exist to support their contention.
Just the thought of tapering, I think, is almost comical at this point. I mean, imagine what would happen to the global economy if they take their collective central banking feet off the pedals. Briefly shift topics here for a moment on the Bitcoin phenomenon we're seeing here. Topped $1,100 in China. Now, keep in mind, that's only in terms of the renminbi before it tanked promptly. Hit $900 officially in the U.S. before dropping to $600. I don't think it's so important economically in isolation, but when we look at it in the bigger picture in terms of the yellow metal and silver and competing currencies outside of the fiat system for what we might see for gold and silver, we've got to exit paper money. I'd like your thoughts on just what Bitcoin could mean for gold and silver investors.
To me, you know, it's just another element of a fiat currency. As I see it, I mean, there's nothing there to support it. And when you talk about gold and silver, let's not forget, you know, gold's been on, what, a 12-year bull run. And yet, even with a 12-year bull run, what percentage of the people buy gold and silver? Now, it has to be, what, about 1% or 2% when you really look at it? So the people aren't really aware of what's going on in the masses. And it's just going to be that small minority of people that keep driving the market. And let's not forget that physical demand for gold keeps going up. It's the paper markets that are being traded down. And there's a lot of speculation, and I have no reason to doubt it, that the markets are being manipulated. And why should I say that? Well, they're rigging the Forex markets. And what is that? Over $5 trillion a day traded. They've rigged the LIBOR rates, the interest rates. That's a fact. So why wouldn't they push down the price of gold and silver? Because the higher those prices go, the more worthless the worthless fiat currencies become. As for bitcoins as well, we're doing a major story on it in the upcoming Trends Journal, which will be out in a week or so. So with all the details as we see it, how it's going to play out, where it's going, who's behind it, and what to expect.
And as we wrap up, China officially ascended to gold consumer superpower. China now is buying about 800 tons of gold compared to India's 715 tons. And this is a first. You know, India has always, as long as I can remember, worn the crown of world's top gold consumer. Of course, the interesting aspect is India does not produce much gold, whereas China is a major gold producer, and they consume not only all that they produce. Middle class is becoming quite affluent. And it would seem to me as though they must at least recognize something that we're missing here in the West.
When you talk about India, look what they're doing. Look what they're talking about, the outflows of money that went into these emerging markets, the hot money that went in. The rupee is crashing against the dollar. It's hitting all-time lows. So what is the Indian government doing? They're making it almost impossible for Indian people to buy gold anymore. Because they see that the people are smart over there and know that their rupee isn't worth anything. And it's just going to keep devaluing in dollars, in value rather, and devaluing against the dollar. So even with that, the Indians are still buying a lot of gold. And as you so correctly point out, you know, China has, you know, I mean, you know, they have a lot of poor people in that country, but there's 1.2 billion of them, and they have, what, like something like 450 million people moving into the middle class. And they're buying gold because they see what's going on in the world. Now, the people in the United States, you know, they don't see beyond the borders, and most of them don't know what's going on. So that's why you have such a small percentage of Americans that really participate in the gold market. And even that small percentage is still enough to keep driving the prices higher, as we saw what happened over the last 12 years. And very important, you mentioned China, you mentioned India. Think of all of those stands, you know, those Kazakhstans, Uzbekistans. Think of Russia. Think of all of the other countries around the world whose central banks are buying more and more gold, countries whose names we never heard of before. And go back to China. Think back in 1980 when gold hit $875. I believe it was on January 20th, 1980, during the trading day, closed at $850. There was no China buying gold. India wasn't buying that much. There was no Russia. There was a Soviet Union. The stands, whoever heard of them. There was nobody knew about Uzbekistan or Kazakhstan or Kyrgyzstan. So what I'm saying is this is a global play now, and it only could be controlled by the central banks and the money forces for only a certain amount of time. And then, as I see it, its gold goes back to the races, and the number that I've been giving it since the beginning is $2,000 an ounce, and accounting for inflation going back to 1980, you know, it should be, what, at about $2,200 an ounce just for that. And when I say that, $2,000 an ounce, let's not forget, I was only, what, $79 off, because in September of 2011, it hit $1,921. So for all intents and purposes, it was there, and I believe it's going to go back to there and beyond.
Tell folks more about the Trends Journal, perhaps some contact information.
Well, it's trendsjournal.com, trendsjournal.com, and besides getting the Trends Journal, we do Trends in the News weekdays at 6:30. That'll bring you on top of the news and way ahead of the trends. We really give history before it happens. So you get all that with your Trends Journal subscription. And again, Chris, we know that people are having a difficult time. There's a discount request page there, so people could just let us know what their situation is. And we try to make the Trends Journal available to everybody so they could read history before it happens.
Gerald Celente, thanks so much.
Thank you, Chris. Always good being on with you.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. The Washington Post featured a story this week titled, Congratulations, America. Your deficit fell 37% in 2013. Fiscal year 2013, that is, which ended September 30th. According to the data, the 2013 deficit was only $680 billion, or 4.1% of GDP. In other words, we only overdrew the national checking account by $680 billion instead of the $1.1 trillion we overdrew the national checking account in 2012. And hey, even better yet, this was the first deficit that was under $1 trillion since the economic collapse in 2008. So what gives? Have all those reports about a, quote, recovering economy actually been true? Why did tax receipts rise $325 billion to $2.77 trillion? Well, for one thing, the payroll tax holiday, in reality a temporary reduction, expired, which caused more money to be withheld from people's paychecks. So workers actually had less money to spend. That doesn't sound all that good for the economy, and is one reason Walmart has continued to report significant pressure on their sales, and recently suggested that looming mandates to buy health insurance will further erode consumer spending. And don't forget, Walmart makes up nearly 2% of GDP. Of course, higher tax rates for upper-income people went into effect, and miraculously, unemployment benefits are down slightly. But as reported in last week's broadcast, that's because the number of non-participants in the workforce has increased. Remember, those folks are no longer unemployed. They are just non-participants. The programming of the American mind continues in full force. The fact is, the only two numbers that matter in this realm are 0 and 100. If you have a job, the unemployment rate is 0%. And if you don't have a job, the unemployment rate is 100%. Unfortunately, as more people become non-participants in the workforce, the 100% number is going to have more relevance for more people. That's especially true when you reflect on Janet Yellen's comments on gold in her testimony this week. She said, "I don't think anybody has a very good model of what makes gold prices go up or down." Maybe she should connect with Robert Rubin, Larry Summers, or Sir Alan Greenspan to discuss that topic. But I expect she already has. I also expect Janet Yellen will print more, not less, money. I expect interest rates will rise dramatically under her tenure. I expect her policies will contribute to more unemployment, not less. And I expect her pretend lack of knowledge or interest in gold will be her undoing. Unless she takes advantage of the inevitable coming rise in the price of the yellow metal to augment what will no doubt be a very dramatic rise in inflation. Remember, she is now on record saying she doesn't think anybody has a very good model of what makes gold go up or down. Maybe Janet should listen to this show. Uncle Ben Bernanke is on record saying nobody really understands gold prices, and he doesn't pretend to understand them either. Ben is smarter than that. He knows. Alan Greenspan is on record saying, central banks stand ready to lease gold in increasing quantities should the price rise. Leasing gold is another term for selling gold. Someone should ask Alan about this statement on his latest book tour and YouTube it. 2008 was a horrific year. It's when open season on the middle class began in earnest. The next round will be even worse, because those who remain in the middle class are sitting ducks. The problem is, it's duck hunting season. Chris, on February 21st and 2nd, I'll be speaking at the second annual Liberty Mastermind Symposium in Las Vegas with 15 speakers, three panel discussions on one amazing day. Details are on my website, and until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.